Support for AHLA comes from PYA. For nearly 40 years, PYA has helped clients find value in the complex challenges related to mergers and acquisitions, clinical integrations, regulatory compliance, business valuations and fair market value assessments, and tax and assurance. PYA is recognized by Modern Healthcare as one of the nation's top 20 healthcare consulting firms and by Inside Public Accounting as a top 100 accounting firm. Learn more at pyapc.com.
Hello, my name is Barry Mathis. We want to thank you for joining us today with this podcast. I am with PYA, as you just heard in the opening message. I have with me a good friend and colleague, Betsy Hodge from Akerman LLP. And together, we are going to talk a bit about now you've been hit with ransomware. It's in the place. You've got it. What do you do next? What are the decisions you make? What are those steps? So, Betsy, I'm going to turn it over to you to kind of tell a little about yourself and your background, and then I'll do the same, and we'll jump into this conversation.
Thank you, Barry. As Barry mentioned, I'm Betsy Hodge with Akerman LLP. I am a member of our healthcare practice group in our West Palm Beach office. I'm also a member of Akerman's cross-practice group data privacy and security team, and most importantly, a proud member of the AHLA Health Information and Technology Practice Group. So I represent healthcare providers and employers with self-insured health plans and advising them on HIPAA compliance and compliance with other state, federal, and international privacy laws and assist them when they do have data incidents. So glad to be here today speaking with you, Barry.
Thanks, Betsy. You and I have enjoyed speaking together on several occasions. I think the last time we spoke together, OCR was there with us. So that was a nice treat to hear their version of some new things coming out. As the principal of IT advisory and consulting of PYA, I have responsibility for compliance, anything to do with IT assessments, compliance, HIPAA. And within that realm, it is the cybersecurity piece that I also work with a team of wonderful folks at PYA to, one, help prevent the sort of thing. And then, unfortunately, if you do have an attack, we're a great resource for helping you navigate through that. And here's what I would say. If you brought us or anybody else in and you've been hit with ransomware, you've got the darn thing. Usually what happens is someone from IT gets a call and says, hey, I've got this weird message on my screen that says I can't reach the database or the system error number. And I call IT. IT spends some time, anywhere from 40 minutes to 2 hours on average, and they discover you've got ransomware, meaning that either one or all, in some cases, of your EHR or supportive systems have been ransomed. That is, they have been encrypted. You can't get to them or use them until you pay somebody some Bitcoin or other cyber currency or cryptocurrency to unlock those. Well, here's what I would tell you. When you call us, we would say, call your lawyer. So with that, I'm going to let Betsy start the conversation because that's the first call that we would make and we recommend anybody makes. Make sure you call the attorney first.
Well, thank you for that plug, Barry. I appreciate it. Yes, you should call your lawyer. And to elaborate on Barry's point, you should identify the lawyer who would assist you in the event of a data incident before you have a data incident. To further follow up on that point, you should identify all of the vendors that you're going to need to assist you with a data incident before you have the incident, because it can take some time, precious time, to try to negotiate those engagements when your business is locked down and every second can count in trying to get you, one, figure out what happened, what you're going to do, and get you back up online. So,
Betsy, it
almost, and another important, oh, I'm sorry, Barry, go ahead.
It almost sounds like they ought to have a plan. Am I right? I mean, it's a lot of things. Maybe what we're saying is you should actually have a plan to respond to this type of event.
That's exactly right, Barry. You should. And I do want to mention one other very important call, and this ties back into your plan in case you have an incident, is to know who your cyber liability carrier is and to have their number on speed dial in the event you have an incident. And to go further with the plan piece, you should know with your cyber carrier what assistance they will provide in the event of an incident. And you should know what your responsibilities are under the policy before you have an event. Are they supposed to be your first call? Will they provide you with incident response counsel? Will they provide you with a forensics team to assist you in identifying what's happening and how to mitigate any harm? So you should have a little phone list of all the important people to call in the event of an emergency. Right. So, and that should be part of your plan.
It should be part of the plan. So we know the topic is you've been hit with ransomware, now what? But let's give us 2 or 3 minutes to back up. Let's talk about the plan for a second. You heard Betsy talk about the call list, which is absolutely part of the plan. You heard Betsy talk about the vendors list, which is an absolute part of the plan, and not just a vendors list, but, you know, hopefully your organization or the organization that you either support or is a client of yours has completed a business impact analysis, and your incident response should tie to that business impact analysis. Obviously in a hospital, the primary EMR, everybody gets that. If Epic's down or Cerner's down or Meditech's down or Allscripts down or CPSI's down, whatever it is, they're going to want that back up fairly quickly. But a lot of these systems simply won't work the way they did before if some of the other ancillary systems that feed into those new interfaces don't work. So make sure that interface piece of it is part of that plan. But in your call list, I would include get to know your regional FBI. We work with a lot of clients through some of our annuitized services. We have one called Overwatch that is kind of outsourcing your IT risk management that allows you to respond quickly as part of that program. And we insist that our clients have some kind of face-to-face or if not video conference with both their regional and even their local field office for the FBI. You don't want your ransomware response, should you get attacked that way, to be the first time you talk to them. There's a lot of questions and you don't know each other, and they're going to ask for things up front. They're going to ask for the data. Are you logging your data? We're going to talk about that as we go forward about the ransomware, but absolutely have a plan, complete your risk analysis. You know, we have the recent, we'll call it a wave. I think there's several publications called it a wave. It was as a result, the CISA updated their advanced persistent threat notification on the Riku virus or Riku, however you want to pronounce it, and the ransomware. And you had, you know, I think it was University of Vermont Health is just now reporting a month after they got hit, they're coming back up. I think Skyline Medical, they took them 2 months to finally come back up. And it wasn't that it took them 2 months to get their primary. It was 2 months to get all those ancillary systems tied in. So that plan going forward to be able to respond quickly is so, so important. But now, Betsy, we've got it. How do you suppose that got in? What's your guess, you and I working in this industry, if we had to put money on it, what's your guess? How did that ransomware get into our facility?
I am going to go out on a limb, Barry, and I am going to say a phishing email.
Exactly.
Yes.
It is the number one, and I don't care what periodical you read or what specialist you talk to, the absolute number one way, the vulnerability to get any type of malware, especially into a hospital or any facility, is through a business email compromise. Someone clicked on something they should not. Now, what a lot of people don't know about this recent wave of attacks is there were a lot of people who were not affected. In other words, they had good server patches. They had good behavioral-based endpoint protection that was able to stop the first wave of that attack, which then resulted in bringing in the ransomware. But there were some that had a few holes and gaps there. And the number one hole is unpatched systems, old legacy systems sitting open on the network. And people tend to focus on that hardened shell, the firewall. There's not many attacks these days that you hear about that got through the firewall. they got through because Barry was in the middle of lunch. He was reading emails while he was trying to do work, and something came across and he clicked it. And sure enough, it launched a piece of malware, which then launched another piece of software that brought the ransomware in. So you are right. Business email compromise. So somebody clicked it. Now our servers are locked up. Our first calls to our lawyers. Now you mentioned earlier, Betsy, and I'm going to turn the microphone back over to you, that the cyber insurance, and you and I have talked about this before, how important that is. There are so many people that don't find out what their cyber insurance truly covers until they need the insurance. And to find out, there are some cyber insurance policies, the underwriter requires you to call their attorney first, even before you call in-house counsel or before you call anyone else. So I'll let you talk about that a little bit, because that's an extremely important part, and that's right in your wheelhouse, that cyber insurance, the exclusions and how you interact with those attorneys and how it could be good or bad outcomes.
So thank you, Barry. And as I mentioned before, you should, as part of your planning, you should know what your cyber insurance requires of you in the event of an incident. And you should have that mapped out as part of your incident response plan. So that when something happens and everybody is scrambling, trying to figure out what's going on, you don't forget to contact your cyber carrier, because you don't want them to be able to say later on, you didn't timely notify us, there is no coverage for this incident. Also, you should understand the conditions of the coverage. As Barry mentioned, are you required to use their panel counsel to assist you with the incident response? Are you required to use their forensic vendor panel to assist you in responding? If you would like to use someone other than who is on the panel, either counsel or the forensic vendor, the time to try to negotiate for the lawyer or vendor of your choice is before something happens. And you may be able to do that as part of negotiating the coverage for your policy. So understand what's required of you and then timely make those contacts so you don't forego coverage because you forgot to make a phone call.
So I'm going to throw something controversial, and I'll use a real world example, because and here's the thing, you know, we work with insurance companies, and I'm often asked and talk with underwriters and insurance companies in different circles, and they understand my position on this, and I understand their position, the job. They have to limit their risk. And I think the best way an insurance company can limit their risk is doing good due diligence up front, which I know there was a shift, I want to say about 5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, where you could renew your cyber insurance policy by simply filling out a few questions and sending it on. Today, not so much. When you get that new insurance policy from Lords of London for your cyber insurance, there's pages and pages of IT stuff that you got to fill out, support, and bring in. And I think that's appropriate. I think that's the right thing to do. I think any underwriter has the right to say, before I sign on to cover you, I need to know, are you doing the basics? Have you done a risk analysis? Do you know where your EPI is? Are you encrypting your devices? I'd like to know what your policy procedures are to be comfortable to even write the policy. Where it gets challenging for me is when an insurance company says, you have to call me first. And I'll give you an example. This was a former client in another life right before I came on PYA about 5 years ago that had a ransomware attack. It was a JBoss ransomware attack. They were down for several weeks, cost them a lot of money. And the very first call they made was their insurance company. And the insurance company sent in a forensic investigator. They sent a team of people. They set up camp there and they ran that whole event from one end to the other. Well, when this particular entity filed for some coverage for some loss during that downtime, they had a significant denial in that because the insurance company pretty much had every piece of evidence they needed to say, you were missing some things here. You weren't doing what you're supposed to. So therefore, and I think that sort of thing is kind of privileged, you know, in these sorts of situations. I think if you have an in-house counsel or an outside counsel, that those are things that should come through discovery, not necessarily just kind of laid out there. So that's where I push back a little bit, and I understand the insurance company and their liability and risk that are associated with it. But, you know, I'll throw that out there to you. Is it always best to have them there first. And I think the point you made is you may not have a choice. If you negotiated a contract that says that, then you're throwing yourself under the bus if you don't at least, you know, adhere to that contract. And I'm saying early on, maybe when you negotiate your cyber insurance policy and you're shopping around, is that you leave the option that, you know, maybe you've got to hire an attorney that has specific skill sets in that and agree to it. But having your own attorney, I think, is far more advantageous for an outcome than just using the insurance company's attorney.
I agree that you need to comply with what your policy says so that you don't
violate,
inadvertently forego coverage. But absolutely, if you have outside counsel that you have been working with that advises you on your cyber security, I absolutely reach out to them too.
Okay.
And you know, some clients will even, they will call law enforcement first, even depending on the circumstances. Now they may not have called counsel first to, before making that decision. You can't always say that we're going to call the carrier first.
Right.
I think most people call outside counsel or in-house counsel first, and
I say a good rule,
and then figure out how to proceed.
Thank you. I say a good rule for anybody, Betsy, is call your counsel first and let your counsel do things. Here's a copy of my cyber insurance policy for you to have and advise us on. And then secondly, hey, I'm about to call the FBI. Are you okay with that? And then listen to counsel's advice. I mean, that's it. Now I would say this, when I say call counsel, and you and I talked about this just as recently as this week, mm-hmm. When I go to buy a piece of property or when I go to sell my property, I make sure I've got a good real estate attorney involved. I want a real estate attorney that sold thousands and thousands of properties. So for that reason, that's specifically what they do. If you're looking for counsel in or out, I wouldn't recommend my real estate attorney, you know, managing your breach. It's not going to turn out well. And I certainly wouldn't, you know, recommend a counsel that's done one breach or that has 2 years experience in there. You're going to need some experience in this area because this is some very touchy ground. And we're going to get into here in a little bit, even things that people on this call or listening to this podcast may not be aware of in terms of the federal government giving guidance on foreign currency and how it affects the rest of the world. So, and whether or not you pay your ransom, which we're about to get into, Betsy, is that something you agree with in terms of the experience of the counsel? Does it matter, or is a lawyer a lawyer?
Well, to your point, just like you would not use a real estate lawyer, no matter how experienced that person was, to assist you with a data breach, you know, nor would I, you know, use a lawyer well versed in responding to data breaches to do a large real estate deal. So yes, experience in the right area matters.
Right. And in some cases they don't have that. A lot of times, you know, and I know there's times where in-house counsel, they kind of take the ball, but you should get involved. And if you are counsel, you know, I've worked with a lot of different attorneys where, you know, in-house counsel simply brought in the specialist as co-counsel. And in terms of planning, if you're an in-house counsel and you're listening to this podcast, or you have an in-house counsel and you're listening to this podcast, and you know, I mean, you do a gut check and you say, listen, this is not something that I want to go cutting my teeth on. I've never done any of these. Then as part of that plan, I would also have that relationship with another co-counsel. Mm-hmm. To say, if my client has a breach, or if I'm the client, if my in-house counsel has a breach, I'd like for us to reach out to somebody that's got experience. It really matters in terms of how well the outcome is in the end, in my experience in watching this play out in several occasions. So, all right. So here's
And Barry, I'm sorry. I was just going to make one further point on that. For those entities that are public entities and have to go through an RFP process to engage outside counsel, you know, you want to do that beforehand. You know, to our point earlier, you should be thinking about all of this beforehand so you have all of the key players lined up in the event you need them, and not go trying to find them or engage them after something happens.
Time is of the essence in these situations.
Yes.
And a lot of the more sophisticated ransomwares, the bad actors have learned that they can apply the pressure by putting fuses on these. So you'll see the countdown on your ransom screen, your notes. It's an electronic, you know, screen in most cases that you go to, and it'll tell you have so many hours or days, and then we're going to destroy the data and you'll never get it. So being able to react quickly is very, very key. So all of this we've set up to so far is start now and either confirm you have this or start the diligence to get this kind of stuff in place and reach out to professionals to help you. Reach out to those that you're comfortable with. If you don't know anybody, call me. I'll be glad to point you to who I think is the best, and we'll get you started there. So now the next thing, let's move into, we've got the ransom. There's two things happening. One, and I'll save the best for last. Do we pay or not pay? Let's save that for the ending, because that's always, do I pay the ransom or not pay the, I've had so many restaurant conversations around that. But let's talk about, is it a breach? I mean, I've got a ransomware, and right now, you know, OCR's kind of default message is, well, of course it's a breach. You were supposed to protect it. You didn't protect it. It's a breach. But there are, you know, three provisions out there for us under the omnibus rule. And the third one of those says, if we can show and prove that whomever was exposed to this accidentally has not done anything with it, we don't expect anything bad to happen, they didn't exfiltrate it, and all that was gained was finances. In other words, we just paid them their $1 million, and we were able to prove. Now, I understand that there's a lot between that prove. That goalpost is very, very, the distances are long. But let's say we could. Is that an option for somebody to say, look, can I even fight this and say, I don't think I had a breach?
I think you can in the right circumstances with the right documentation. And we've kicked this around, Barry, before. And I think not only do you have that third exception to the definition of a breach, but also in the ransomware guidance that OCR issued, in which it stated the default position that a ransomware attack is a breach. They do say that if you can, even if you don't fall in any of the three exceptions, if you do the risk assessment, for perhaps more factor risk assessment, and can determine there's a low probability of compromise, then you may be able to take the position that a ransomware attack is not a breach. However, OCR does require that the assessment that you do has to be thorough, completed in good faith, and you have to reach conclusions that are reasonable given the circumstances. And I think that ties back to the point you're making, that if you can document, if you have the proof, if you have the artifacts that the data was not compromised, was not exfiltrated, they just came in, they locked it down, they just want their money, you paid them, they released, they gave you the key, and they're out of your system. In that case, assuming you've got sufficient documentation and artifacts, you may be able to say we did not have a reportable breach under OCR's definition.
And you hit the nail on the head. That's the key, the artifacts, the evidence. And OCR, and rightly so, they're not going to believe anything your IT department tells them. So you having your IT department write an extensive report, which basically comes up to conjecture that says, we don't think there was a breach because we did all these things, that's not going to work. For example, if you had a business email compromise and you're using Office 365 and you currently do not have your logging turned on for 365, there's no way you're going to be able to prove there was no exfiltration if there, you know, if it was an email that sent it, that sort of thing. You're not logging, you're not tracking it. If you're not managing those ports, if you're not looking at the size and packets that are going across, if you can't say this is the average number and these are the locations that files are transferred to, and be able to show, you know, through an attestation where you swear to the fact based on your reports and logs and add those logs in there, then that's the kind of stuff that OCR is talking about, in my experience. They're not talking about someone describing the environment and talking about all the good things that they're doing and just filling out an affidavit saying, I guarantee you nothing left. That's not going to fly. They want to see those artifacts. And I think that's key. The point you made is absolutely key. And I agree with you. If you can do that, it's a rare thing these days, because let's face it, you know, logging is overhead. You know, systems mm-hmm. that do that kind of logging is additional money. And, you know, healthcare, we haven't spent that kind of money in those areas. It's not a high value in terms of the rest of the enterprise by default. But again, maybe that's one of those things you put in your due diligence as you create your plan. You ask some basic questions, and you can ask them at the macro level. Hey, CIO, hey, CTO, hey, IT director, hey, CISO, if we had to prove without opening our mouths, if we duct taped our mouths and had to prove to anybody that we're tracking all of our information and we can tell you if something leaves this organization, regardless of where it's going, could we do that? And if the answer is no, then you do an assessment evaluation, because in some cases, the cost of doing that outweighs, you know, some of the impact. But I'll just tell you, a system being down for 2 months, you know, Lakeside, the system being down for a month, you know, Vermont, that's a costly thing, even with the cyber insurance, just on your community and your patients, that's a costly thing. So consider that. So let's toss out the next big grenade, and that is.
Could I circle back on the point you were making about logging yes. and the cost benefit analysis of how much logging you do? And for those out there whose clients are currently doing logging, great. But one thing to think about now is we're seeing that the ransomware attacks are changing, they're evolving. And so, whereas before you might have someone, you know, in the good old days where they were just interested in a relatively low level ransom amount, they would come into the system, not be in there very long, launch the ransomware, you pay the ransom, and they get out. Or you don't pay the ransom, but they move on to the next victim. But now we're seeing bad actors being in your systems for much longer before they launch the actual ransomware attack. And so you may need to think about, do you need to lengthen the window for your logging capability to be able to demonstrate, should something happen, that the bad actors during that period of time they were in your system before they launched the ransomware, that they did not exfiltrate data. So that highlights another point that you need to constantly be aware of how the threats are changing, and you need to adapt your defense and safeguards appropriately.
All right. So you've exposed a whole nother thread. Let's pull on that one a little bit. I like this. The bad actors, the ransomware, it has evolved. It's not like it was before. They're well organized. They've all got mascots and names, and some of them make sense. When you say the Panda Advanced Persistent Threat Group and hackers, you think of China, and that's exactly who it is. North Korea's got one. By the way, North Korea has upped their activity here lately. They've got a lot of things going on, and they all react differently. And that's one of the reasons you can reach out to the FBI. You want to reach out to the FBI. They know all this stuff. They can look at your ransomware. They can look at the ransom note and know who's attacking you. And some great advice that the FBI can give you early on is whether or not you can expect to get your keys if you pay the ransom, which we're going to talk about paying the ransom at the very end. But these ransomwares that come in these days, they're not as easily to detect. Behavioral-based endpoint protection is a must. They'll come in fragmentations. They'll come in little bits of pieces of software that may not detect a dictionary type endpoint protection. And they call other software in, much like the RIP virus or ransomware did. They'll call these things in. So it's not as easy to detect them as it was in the past. So from that perspective, they've all changed. And you're right. In most cases, the bad actors have been in there for quite some time. and they don't just sit there. In the old days, they just sit there, let time pass to kind of throw you off the scent. They're active, and you know, especially if they detect that you're not doing a lot of monitoring, because they can look for certain evidence within your system that says, oh, look, they have, you know, they have this type of monitoring system, we'll sit quietly. But if they don't see that, they'll move around inside the system. If they can find your backup and somehow, you know, mess with your backups and you're not checking those or testing the restore capabilities, one of the things they'll do is they'll sit and mess with your backup strings for months at a time. Because the first thing you're going to do if you decide you're not going to pay the ransom is, well, we'll just go ahead and start our restore. You go to do the restore and find out that there's been a corrupt file out there for 2 months, and you're going to have to go back 3 months to do a restore. You're like, well, that's not an option. So now you're back to paying or not paying the ransom. So they're very smart, very sophisticated. They no longer simply do a hack. They do campaigns, and those campaigns involve multiple layers, especially for the big bad actors. You're talking about the dragons, the pandas, the spiders, and that's, you know, Russia and China, North Korea, South Africa, and some other, or North Africa, and some other places. So those folks are no longer, it's not a, you know, 15-year-old in the basement eating Twinkies and drinking Mountain Dew, you know, like it was in the 80s. It is corporate organizations that make a lot of money doing this. And to your point, if you haven't updated your response plan, if you're sitting here and within the sound of my voice in this podcast and you say, well, Barry, we did that 4 years ago. Okay. Well, you need to look at it again because the environment's changed. You know, you may not have the same steps in there that can help you as much as the current, and talk to somebody about the current bad actors and the advanced persistent threat groups that are out there and update your policies, procedures, your plans around the reaction to a ransomware accordingly. Ready for the last grenade? We got a few minutes.
Let's do it.
All right. I'm a former CIO, CTO. My job as a CIO is to keep that system up. I understand from the CFO and the CEO and the board of trustees, that system goes down. It's a bad thing. So when somebody says, tell me, you know, give me $1 million or I'm going to have your system down for 3 months, I'm writing the check. I mean, that's who I am. It's where I am. But I know that flies in the face of the FBI. And Scott Agenbaum, I've got his book right here, The Secret to Cybersecurity, wrote a great book. And he would argue with me because he toes the line for the FBI, even though he's retired. He's a great guy. And we've had these conversations. But still, if I'm the CIO and the hospital's going to be down for months and I can avoid that, one, I'd want to know who my attackers are, and I'd want the FBI to at least let me know that. I'd want to know what my chances are about getting my keys to unlock my data. For example, the one incident that I told you as part of an example earlier, that same hospital that had that ransomware attack, when they eventually did pay their ransom and they got their keys, but they only got a portion. So let's say you had 500 systems affected and they give you 20 keys. Well, now you got to prioritize what 20 do you bring? And then they went away. They didn't ask for any more. They just went away and, you know, you had to deal with it. So you want to know all that information. But at some point, I'm going to say, do I pay or not pay, Betsy? But I think you've got some information on why that may not be a good thing from a global standpoint.
You're right, Barry. Do you pay, do you not pay decision got a little more difficult to make when on October 1st of this year, the Department of Treasury issued an advisory on potential sanctions risks for facilitating ransomware payments. And in that guide, the advisory, the Office of Foreign Assets Control explains that companies that facilitate ransomware payments to cyber actors who happen to be on the OFAC sanctions list, those companies could face liability, strict liability for making those payments, because those bad actors who are identified as being on the sanctions list would then use that money to further their illegal goals. So there is now exposure for companies who make the payments or who facilitate. So it's not just the hospital that has the ransomware attack, but if anybody assists the hospital in making the ransomware payment, those entities also have potential liability under this advisory. So it will be interesting to see if your cyber carrier will be as willing to make a ransom payment, or whether some of the vendors that assist in negotiating and making the ransom payment on your behalf, if they will be willing to do that. One thing I do want to note in the advisory is that if you do make a ransom payment, one mitigating factor that OFAC will take into consideration is, did you immediately contact law enforcement about the ransomware attack before you made the ransom payment? And so this might be, you know, another reason to reach out to local law enforcement once you have a ransomware attack. And in some cases, law enforcement has been able to tell the victim, based on the information you've provided us, we can tell you that this particular bad actor is not on the sanctioned list. So you could go ahead and make the payment and have some comfort that you wouldn't have exposure under this OFAC advisory.
And there's other factors too. You and I, again, you and I have discussed this on more than one occasion. And you know, as when I was a CIO for a hospital or a chief technology for a hospital system, that was kind of where my loyalties. I got to keep this system up. Now, as an advisor and a consultant within PYA, what we typically do is say, listen to your attorney, because we're not attorneys. You know, we're business advisors. We can tell you the impact of the organization. We can advise you to do a business impact analysis. You know, we help clients with what does that ramp up look back, you know, look like coming back up with all those systems should you decide not to pay it, all these kind of things. But the attorneys are the ones that advise pay or not pay. I would say never let a consultant tell you to pay or not pay. There's a lot of legal things that can happen there. Now, there's another part of this that people may not, you and I both know at least one case where a patient died and was attributed to the fact that the ransomware took the services out. The patient could not get services at one hospital and had to be transferred. And during the transfer, the patient died. And in that investigation, I think they said the patient might have had certainly an increased chance of living had they been able to be treated at that hospital. So they put it on the ransomware. They literally said the ransomware was part of this patient's death. Not exactly what caused the death, but it certainly had an impact.
That's right. And I think, and this case was in Germany, just to let the audience know, it did not happen in the U.S., but that does not mean it could not happen in the U.S., especially since we are in the middle of a pandemic. And, you know, we are seeing increases all year. We've seen increases in ransomware attacks. And you bring up a good point, Barry, that as part of, and we're circling back to response plans again. As part of your response plan, not only should you think about data security, but you also need to think about patient safety. If your systems were taken offline by a ransomware attack and you have a full emergency room because it's now flu season and we have a pandemic and just your normal caseload, what are you going to do with all those patients? And what if several hospitals in your area were hit by ransomware at the same time? Where are you going? What are you going to do with these patients to be able to safely care for them? And so I think that needs to be a bigger feature of especially hospitals' incident response plans going forward, if it isn't already.
Very good points. Very good points. The last thing I'll leave with is just a recent update on some monitoring and activity on the dark web, listening to the forums and what's going on out there compared to what was happening during, you know, March, January, February, and March earlier in the year. And then I'll turn it, Betsy, I'll let you close it out for us with any final thoughts. But, you know, early on in the pandemic, you know, everybody was nervous that our security is getting relaxed a bit, our posture is relaxed a bit, and we're going to get attacked, you know, by these hackers. And what happened was there was actually a bit of honor among thieves as you listen to, you know, some of the forums and watch those on the dark web in these areas that have the data auctions. And then even, you know, outside of those areas, just conversation. And what was evolving was people saying, look, you know, granted, we're the bad guys here, but we may need these services. It could be the very hospital that my family needs to go to, because, again, these are a lot of these folks as hackers in these organizations, they're people with jobs just like anybody else. They go to and they have families, they have houses, they have things to support. They're using a very immoral way to do it, but yet it's still their family, it's still the way they support them. So they were concerned about that. So it was, look, let's not attack. Let's not bring down the very systems. Now, the Ukraine violated that out of the gate. They brought down their children's hospital within just a month or so with a ransomware. But for the most part, that actually happened. Everybody kind of settled down. But further in that conversation, say 2 or 3 months later, in the May and June timeframe, it was, well, if we're not going to attack, could we at least infiltrate and sit and wait and plan? And that was, oh, that's a great idea. There's money to be had here. So while we were still relaxed, they weren't executing the attacks, but they were doing the infiltrations and sitting. And that's why those who aren't monitoring are likely more at risk than those who do diligent monitoring during that time. And we saw some people get, I think that's going to continue. My personal opinion, Barry Mathis' opinion, is that's going to continue. One, from other conversations just as recently as this week, the conversation is the hospitals now have money. They've been handed stimulus money. There's a lot of conversation about Trump and what Trump's done and these things, that these hospitals handed buckets of money. Now, I'm not saying or agreeing with that. I'm saying that's what's being said in the dark web. And for that reason, these folks have been waiting, have said, look, now's the time to go out there and do something about it. Now, we've had a resurgence, at least in the U.S. and some states. We'll see how that affects it, you know, over the next month or so. But at least right now, I think they're lifting that kind of that honor among thieves ban, and they're starting to execute some of those attacks. They're not using very sophisticated methods right now. The Riot virus or the ransomware that hit is not a sophisticated piece of software. The software that called it in was fairly, it's been around for a long time. It's not quite as easy to use, but once it's in there, it brings in something like the Riot, which is, again, a very, you know, not very sophisticated piece of ransomware, but very effective. So I think there's going to be more of that. And I think it's going to get, you know, more sophisticated. And I'm thinking there's going to be one or two really big ones it's a big giant wave. This I would consider a very small wave. What we experienced in October, I think, was a small wave. So my advice is start your diligence now, create your plan. If you had a plan that's old, revisit that plan, know what you're going to do when you get hit. Ransomware, unfortunately, is like those who ride motorcycles. They'll tell you there's two types of people who ride motorcycles, those who've laid one down and those who will lay one down. I think ransomware is the same way. It's hospitals that have been attacked, and then there's those hospitals that will be attacked and not much else.
Those are some very sobering thoughts, Barry. And I have a few to add based on what we've seen recently. And picking up on your point about dusting off your incident response plan. That is even more important now during the pandemic, because the pandemic has changed the way a lot of organizations work. While many of the caregivers in health systems are still there working on site day in, day out, a number of other functions have been working remotely, and then other entities in the healthcare space may be able to work remotely entirely. Well, that changes your threat vectors, and it makes people more susceptible to the phishing emails that launch these attacks. So I would suggest looking at your incident response plan to see if it still works in the age of COVID. Are all the people that are on your incident response team, are they still there? We know that early in the pandemic, a number of institutions had to make a lot of layoffs. So you want to make sure that your team, everybody knows who the team is, and the team can respond. Also, consider whether your operations have changed and how they've changed because of the pandemic, and do you need to update your plan to address that? What if you have to respond to an incident remotely? I recently worked on an incident with a client that had to do that. some things you may need to think about in a quarantine that you, or the pandemic that you had not thought about before may include if you need boots on the ground to assist you with bringing your systems back up. Can you get those boots on the ground because of the number of cases? A lot of vendors who assist in this space have more work than they know what to do with. And so there can be issues in getting sufficient support on the ground. Also, you have to think about how travel bans because of coronavirus or quarantine requirements related to coronavirus may affect your ability to get boots on the ground in from other places. We ran into that on a matter for a client recently. I had never thought that that might be an issue, but it was. And so you've got to, you know, anticipate issues like that. And then I think to your point about the phishing emails, it's so critical to continue with training your employees to be able to identify potential phishing emails and avoid them. It's especially now when you have either people are working remotely and are stressed because of that, or they're in a busy, even busier work environment and are stretched thin. It's so important that they not let their guard down about phishing emails, and because that is your first line of defense, really, or and maybe your last line of defense. So it's important that they be aware of that on top of everything else that they're dealing with. And I know that's a huge ask, but the training can really pay off.
It is a constant. It is a, first of all, I think you and I could do a whole nother hour or two or three on ransomware in the middle of the pandemic and COVID. That would be such a good conversation. How do we actually go through this plan? How do we do this? I mean, what if the FBI says, great, but I'm not coming over there. Send me your stuff. You know, all these kind of things. But on the email, you know, I'm a realist when it comes to that. And that is, you're never going to prevent someone from clicking something they shouldn't. You can drive the risk out, you can reduce it, but human beings are fallible. We do things that oftentimes we don't want to do. We do them by accident. That's part of our nature. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a responsibility to those who provide oversight and protection that you should expect that. You should have things in place. You should know that somebody's going to click something like that. You should have the tools and things in the past. But having said, tools in place to prevent or react to that. But knowing that, you should stay on the training and education all the time. There should be flyers. There should be emails. There should be a good. One of the best training tools out there is examples. When you hear of an infiltration based on an email compromise, sharing that with your colleagues, and you know, don't let it be you. Don't let it happen to us. That's some of the best work you can do. And it's not a quarterly. It's certainly not an annual basis. It is a weekly kind of thing. I mean, a daily in some places. The larger you are, the more susceptible, the higher your risk. Mm-hmm. But the business email compromise for at least the foreseeable future is going to be the vector, we call it, that they're going to come in for their payloads. So, yeah. Well, Betsy, it's been great. I want to thank AHLA for inviting us to sit and talk in this podcast. Betsy, thank you so much for joining me.
And thank you, Barry. It was a pleasure as always.
All right. I'll see you soon. Thanks again, HLA, and everybody listening. Get your plan together. It could happen to you.